Blog Talk Radio.
I'm a truth terrorist. I'm a knowledge gangster. I'm a black history hitman. I'm a lie killer, urban gorilla. I gotta be a roughneck.
Free the Black Panthers. FCBP. Stand for Free the Black Panthers. And fuck the black police. That 13th Amendment. Trying to make a slave of me. You can lock my body, can't trap my mind, not forever be free.
Okay,
free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for free the Black Panthers, and fuck the black police. Feds infiltrated our movements for black leadership roles. But we still here, finna build here, fuck coins, hell bro.
Show.
They got me started, lying hearted, I'm the new Mufasa. And I'm all about Umoja, first in Gruz Usaba. Let's bring back the black families, we need our father. Single mama, son and daughter, that's root of the problem. Wise up, we wise up, unity is so powerful. Black banks, black schools, black on, black power moves. You telling lies, you think this shit won't be televised. Black power, be scared guys, they be standing there like they paralyzed, huh? We say fuck the system, cause we above the system. We keep ARs and pistols, shotguns that's worth the crystal. But that's for self-defense, make sure we have no issues. Be sure to leave it at the door if you have it with you. This for them freedom fighters, that lost their freedom. Until they freedom, we screaming carpe diem. This for the general, King Khalid Muhammad. We gon' make your day a holiday, I fucking promise.
Free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for free the Black Panthers, and fuck the black police. That 13th Amendment, tryna make a slave of me. You can lock my body, can't trap my mind, not forever be free.
Okay,
free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for free the Black Panthers, and fuck the black police. Feds infiltrated our movements for black leadership roles. But we still here, finna build here, fuck coins, hell pro.
RBG, 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 RBG. My sisters, my brothers, the council, the elders, and that's really all I need. We suited, we booted, don't do it, you stupid, we head to the armory. Black woman and goddess, regardless, my heart just don't fuck with misogyny. Bullshit, I don't tolerate it. Melanated, so you gotta hate it. Barack fucked up another conversation. Trump finna get inaugurated, damn. Unify or die, NBPP.org.
First and foremost, the new Black Panther Party, no other Black Panther Party, we are not violent. We are for self-defense and self-determination. The most violent group in this country are the police. What is taking place by the police department to black people across this country is ethnic cleansing and genocide. It has escalated since the day that Barack Obama was inaugurated in 2008. We have a people who are only 13% of the population, yet we make up 80% of the prisons. We have 50% unemployment rate in the black community, and it's actually even more than that because they're not counting our people that are in the prison. The 13th Amendment says you cannot be made a slave or indentured servant unless you commit a crime. The 14th Amendment forced our people to be subjects of this government. We never had any say in that. We need our own nation.
Black power, brothers and sisters, black power. Thank you for listening to the new Black Panther for Self-Defense Nightly Broadcast. Tonight, Thursday night, we're going to continue with our Pan-African news briefing updates, and we will play a clip from Pan-African TV, which will give us an update from the Good Morning Africa program, as well as hot news. This is going to be broadcasted live. It will be the first time not only our audience has heard it, but we have heard it. So hopefully we'll get some good info as to what's taking place on the continent, as well as the diaspora. Black power.
Right, welcome to Thursday, the 17th of March, 2022. My name is Kwame Owusu-Dan. So thank you very much for choosing Pan-African Television. We're streaming live on Facebook, facebook.com/Pan-African Television. We are also on YouTube. You can share with us what your thoughts are via those platforms, and we'll try and read them here for you. This one, I've been joined in the studios by Elvis Botta, Honorable Enos Afuseni, Mr. Kwesi Pratt. Let me quickly take you through the topics, and then we'll kickstart. Blame Western sanctions on Russia for price hikes across Africa, not Ukraine war. Russian embassy says that coup monger granted 2 million bail, the front page of the Daily Guide. Demolishing of Bulgarian embassy in Accra sparks anger in parliament, is on the front page of the Insight newspaper. 84 unqualified cadets enter police college. Daybreak. Stop publishers from printing textbooks offshore. Texan. Daily Graphic. Let me just read a little bit of the African story. Blame Western sanctions on Russia for price hikes across Africa, not Ukraine war. Ukraine-Russian war. Nairobi. The Russian embassy in Kenya has dismissed reports that the country's invasion of Ukraine is to blame for the high cost of living in the continent. The embassy tweeted Wednesday in response to remarks by Kenya's State House spokeswoman, Kanze Dena, that fuel prices in the country were triggered by the crisis with Ukraine. Russian embassy in Kenya would like to point out to our Kenyan friends and partners that the real cause of the increase in prices in Africa is not Russia's special military operation in Ukraine, but the illegal unilateral sanctions imposed by the US, EU, and their followers on Russia, the embassy tweeted. Fuel prices shot up by 5 shillings on Monday in what was blamed on the Russia-Ukraine crisis. The Russian embassy statement follows remarks by Dena that the rising cost of living is not exclusive to Kenya. It's a global phenomenon fueled by numerous external factors, among them the Russian-Ukraine war. Elvis, you subscribe to that.
Last week we had the opportunity to take a bite on the happenings in Ukraine and then its effect on Africa as a continent, and the lazy and in some cases stupid posture of African leaders in respect of saying. I think that in all of this, the truth about the matter has to do with the tensions in the international space being fueled by the actual enemy of the world, whom nobody seemed to be paying much attention to. The fundamental question we should be asking, even before we apportion blames, if any, would have to do with delving into the root cause of these anarchic happenings within the international domain. I have always maintained that undoubtedly Russia's invasion of Ukraine, which I think is overly justified. In fact, there are every reasons under the sun why Putin is right to behave in the manner he has behaved. And I've always maintained that I would do worse if I were to be in the position of Putin. So the primary issue we should be looking at here is the fact that who is the one within the international domain struggling for, hegemonic prowess. There is this country, there are this group of people who think that they must be the big brother to every other country. There are this group of people who think that they are more knowledgeable than any other group of people in the world. The same group of people think that their interest, supersedes the interest of any other person in the world. And so the rest of the world must now go back to sleep and allow them to pursue their whimsical caprices to the disadvantage of the rest of the world, even to the peril of the rest of the world whom they decide or they wish to rule. These same people, group of people, at the center of all these controversies are also those who colonized Africa. A primary thing we should be asking ourselves is, throughout the history of civilization, who are the people responsible for imperial movements? Who are the group of people who have colonized the vast majority of the world, not only Africa, but even Asia and other continents? Who are the group of people who poke their nose in the name of international law and democracy, poke their nose into the affairs of other sovereign states? Who are the people in world history renowned for creating anarchy, okay, within political systems of independent African states. Who are the people who colonized your grandfathers, my grandfathers? Who are the people sponsoring all manner of, you know, tensions in Africa? Who are the people behind the exploitation of our resources? Who are the people behind the underdevelopment of Africa? Who are the people who come in the name of foreign aid, give us with the right, and turn around to collect multitudes with the left? Who are the people? Who are the people who have made it practically impossible for Africa to be economically independent and truly emancipated? Who are the sponsors of sin? Who are behind the overthrow of the founding fathers of Africa who were forthright? Dr. Kwame Nkrumah, Mandibu Keita, Julius Nyerere. Who were the people sponsoring these activities? These are the same group of people who think that today Russia should not also rest. It is now time for them to cripple Russia. I support Russia and will not blame Russia for any of this, because the same group of people are responsible for the price hikes. It can't be Russia. And you know whom they are. Your guess is as good as mine. And without missing words, I am talking about the American people. I am talking about the United States of America and its, you know, surrogates and cohort and affiliates who think that they are a special breed of individuals. And so the rest of the world must now go down our knees to allow for extreme westernization of even our culture and traditions. These are the very group of people who think that a man marrying two wives, three wives, four wives in the name of polygamy is sinful and evil. But now comes to tell us that a man who marries another man is only exercising a sexual right. And a woman who marries another woman is also exercising a sexual right. This is where we are, the hypocrisy of the world. Look, all these tensions can come to a halt if America chooses to be reasonable and fair, first of all to itself, and second to the rest of the world. KOD, Russia did not colonize Africa. Russia did not at any point in time rob Africa or any continent of its precious resources. Russia is not renowned for sponsoring anarchy in other countries. Russia is not responsible in breaking democratic pillars in Africa. Russia did not kill Patrice Lumumba. Russia did not oust Dr. Kwame Nkrumah. Russia cannot be the problem for Africa and the rest of the underdeveloped world. If there is any problem, if there is any virus affecting us critically, it is the virus of the United States of America, and in this case, the EU ably backing them. Today, if Russia is fighting a cause for its own integrity, and we have said it on many occasions, even on this platform, how greedy Americans have been, how America have violated every single treaty, every single protocol they have had with even Russia after the collapse of the Soviet Union. In fact, in terms of international security, Russia went ahead to dissolve and to decommission the Warsaw Pact. What is NATO? What is the relevance of NATO still within the international space? America should be answering this question to the rest of the world. So you see, this I know it all attitude, and I'm the master of creation, and apart from God, there is no other than me, is the problem. So if today, U.S. at one point in time forced Russia to pack out their nuclear parts from Cuba in the name of it being of proximal threat to the safety of America, what is the interest of America in the vast majority of Eastern European countries and former Soviet Union states that they have now brought into NATO? And the final assault is to now bring Ukraine also into NATO as a means of undermining the safety and territorial integrity of Russia. And I think the Russian people should be stupid. They should keep quiet. They shouldn't keep quiet. There is always a reaction to every action. It's a fundamental law of motion and physics. So U.S. should not think that they do the things they do and expect other countries. For example, Russia, with whom they have a long-standing period of sustained and military tensions with, to shut up and sit down. It has not happened that way. They can pursue their rise to hegemony through very constructive international engagement, not through this announced tricks, this spider tricks. Every story you have read about Koko Anansi, just reflect well on America, and you realize that every Koko Anansi story is actually about the nature and being of the American people. And I'm happy, and I'm ending on this note, that Donald Trump has mentioned that, look, the lack of leadership of the American people, the lack of leadership of Biden's administration is partly responsible for the aggression we are seeing now. So the problem in price hikes of goods cannot be at the instance of Russia. Not when you, same United States of America and the EU, have imposed unnecessary economic sanctions on them. You have cut off the importation, or shall I say, the sending of luxury goods, in some cases even medicinal products, to Russia. And you think that Russia should open its doors and its windows to keep on sending what they have to the rest of the world. You cannot search from the basin and expect the water not to reduce. Is it right? So price hikes and whatever should be laid at the doorsteps of the U.S. And please, we're begging and calling on the United States of America, even through their embassy in Ghana, that they should reconsider their foreign policy, you know, ambitions, okay? They should reconsider their foreign policy ambitions, realizing that a lot of them are endemic to the rest of the world. We see what happens in India. We see what's happening in Cyprus. We see what's happening in Pakistan, okay? As for Africa, the least talk about it, the better. Liberia, we saw what happened. Syria, we saw what happened. Gaddafi's country, Libya, we saw what happened. And America is always at the center of all this controversy. If there's any devil to blame, that devil is America. If there is any demon to cast out, that demon is America.
Well, thank you very kindly, Elvis Buta, for this brilliant submission. Let me now come to Honorable Inusa Fuseni, the farmer.
Yes, so yes, when your neighbor's house is on fire, you take advice and look for water close by. Position water close by you so that when your house is on fire, you can extinguish the fire. So Kenyans are saying that the fuel prices, the government should do something about the increasing cost of fuel in their country. This is a warning to our Ghanaian leaders. That is coming home. It's coming home fast. The fuel distributors have said that by the end of this week, fuel prices might hit 10 cedis per liter. In fact, some filling stations have already indicated that, Shell has indicated that, in total, that is 10 cedis per liter.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, 2 days ago, or was it just yesterday, I bought fuel in my car, 300 Ghana cedis. When I was driving here, when I was coming to town, I bought the fuel at Kwabena filling station. Came into town, went back. As I was driving back, my fuel indicator is telling me that I need to buy more fuel. Well, in a country where now if you buy fuel into your car, actually, you fear to drive the car. Because, you see, because when you drive the car, the fuel will finish, and you won't have money to buy more fuel. That's the situation in which we are. And I don't blame Russia, and I don't blame America. What is the research unit of the security intelligence of this country doing? Or what was it doing? When the signs were clear that Russia might invade Ukraine, knowing that Russia supplies the world with huge resources, huge petroleum resources. I mean, Germany is having a difficulty to take a decision on sanctioning Russia on energy because Germany depends on Russian energy close to about 40%. Or Europe in general depends on Russian energy. And so the sanctions regime that are being imposed...
Did not include energy supply.
Did not include energy supply. And because their argument is simply that the sanctions on energy will hurt Germany more than it will hurt Russia. So clearly, here we sat and said, the very, very first week that the war started, crude oil prices had jumped to $105 dollars per barrel and never experienced for a very long time. And so countries had to adjust. Yes, so clearly the war is one reason why we have fuel prices. Even without the sanctions, we knew that supplies would be disrupted. It's not only fuel, even food crops. The General Secretary of the United Nations had said that poor countries in Africa will suffer more from the war between Russia and Ukraine, because both Ukraine and Russia produce huge quantities of wheat, and they're cheap. And so poor countries in Africa get their supplies from both Russia and Ukraine. The war has disrupted that. And so bread prices will increase. I mean, if you are going to, you can't have that cheap supply, so it will increase. We have been told that Russia produces a lot of fertilizer. Sanctions will affect farmers. In the next farming season, they will have cheap fertilizer. And so, the consequences of the war are going to be quite drastic on African countries. But we must look inward and blame our leaders. Because, you see, you can't live on a day-to-day basis as a leader. You can't rule the country on a day-to-day basis and on top basis. Say, well, let's do this then tomorrow and let tomorrow take care of itself. That's not how you plan a country. That's not how you govern a country.
Knee-jerk.
Knee-jerk reactions to economic development of the country. That's where we are. When COVID struck, they thought that COVID was the worst that had happened to the economy. The NDC government had established the stabilization fund and said part of our petroleum resources, the resources that we will get, the money that we will get from selling our petroleum, should be put in the stabilization fund to be able to correct distortions that might occur by reason of changes in the economic outlook.
Absolutely.
For the MPP government, that economic change in the economic outlook was COVID. So they raided the stabilization fund. 2 days ago, I was reading John Dramani Mahama. I said, no, my boss, don't talk. Don't talk. The history will bear you out. When they said John Dramani Mahama was incompetent, he could not manage the economy of this country. In 2016, not a single city was borrowed from the Bank of Ghana to help the country, to help the government run the country. Not a single city. All the money that was raised to run this country was raised from taxes. And that's why NDC was confident to say that even assuming that we are going to borrow, we should not borrow beyond 5% of the budget. But we didn't borrow at all. NDC did not borrow at all. Not borrowing was equated to incompetence. To the COVID, when it came, they said, challenge the fundamentals of our economy. And so they went, Bank of Ghana alone, they took close to 30 billion Ghana cedis from Bank of Ghana. So clearly, we don't have buffers. Now there are no buffers. Now that an e-levy cannot go, now that the road tolls have been cancelled, now that the taxes are not coming in, now that you've restored the benchmark values and disturbing farmers, because farmers cannot sell their produce and compete against imported products. So Food prices, when they increase, will affect the ordinary Ghanaian. Just like fuel prices, when they increase, they affect the ordinary Ghanaian, and they are affecting the Kenyans as well. So you see, my submission today is that, yes, the war, American actions, European actions, Russian actions, Ukrainian actions would have led us into this difficulty. But don't we have a responsibility as a people? Doesn't the government have a responsibility as the group in charge with the management of the affairs of this country to put in place strategies to mitigate whatever hardships that will come as a result of unforeseen consequences like Russia invading Ukraine? Don't we have that responsibility? And if our government fails in putting in place systems that will mitigate the buffer stock. So what grains have they bought? So we have the buffer stock. It's an institution. Then we thought that, look, things like this could happen. So let's establish the buffer stock company. Have they been given money enough? Have they stocked up enough foodstuff to be able to release onto the market? Bust. Bulk oil storage was transportation or something like that. Bust. What is in their fuel tank? What's there that we can release periodically to cushion the rise in fuel? Government is between the rock and the hard place because we are not getting the needed revenue. Last month, public workers had to be paid in some days in March, because government could not keep to the commitment, its commitment, to pay them by 25th of February. Here on this platform, we all agreed that if nothing is done this month, and is we were all commenting on what the Speaker Bagben has said, that if nothing is done, this month will be far more worse than February, and that we don't know what will happen in April. So what is government? What is government's strategic plan? What is Nana Akufo-Addo and his government doing? Drivers are warning that if nothing is done about the fuel increases, they might have to take to the streets and demonstrate. The fuel price buildup still contains some taxes. Is government willing and able to let those taxes go to reduce the price of fuel? Will government do that? Or because government is not getting enough revenue, government will still stick to the price buildup and pass the hardship to the people of this country? All this is a management problem. It's a management problem. Why are other countries within the West African sub-region not having these problems? Togo, for instance, they're not facing this problem. They're not facing spiraling fuel prices. So why haven't we been able to manage our own affairs in such a way that we could mitigate whatever hardships that this war could bring to our country, Ghana? And I put it squarely at the doorstep of leadership. I have said since the beginning of 2017 that this government appears to lack direction. They're doing things like Pilolo. You know the game we used to play as small boys, Pilolo.
Yeah.
Catch me if you can. That's what they're doing. And that is what has led us to where we are. Nobody is now speaking. The finance minister is not speaking because what is he going to say? He says we have been chased out of the money market. We can't go and borrow again. And we are now almost a dead distance, but this was sounded to us long time ago. I mean, the dollar flight in this country is so, intense that it's affecting the demand for dollars in Ghana. It's affecting the value of the cedi. And now the value of the cedi is falling like dry leaves in the Harmattan. Because everything is going out. People are now looking for dollars everywhere. And so people have, and you know the rules of the law of demand and supply. When a commodity is demanded more, the price what? So the price of dollar is going up. And if the price of dollar is going up, the price of our cities, and the price of city going up affects the price of fuel at the pump.
Absolutely.
Because we bring it in. Even though we can console ourselves that we produce some oil, some crude oil, it's not enough to mitigate whatever, because we only have a share.
18%.
18% share.
Terribly
so true. We are in deep crisis. I think that better late than never. The fact that Nana Akufo-Addo's government cannot do all does not prevent them from doing something. It's a proverb in my local language, the Bane. It says that if you can't do all, that doesn't prevent you from doing something. So they should do something. We know they can do all, but they should do something. They should demonstrate leadership. They should mitigate the hardship. So even if it was not now, in 2000 and in 2000 to 2004, my brother here, Kosi Pras, and others took to the streets when it was not even like this. So we have given Nana Akufo-Addo and his government a lot of opportunities to demonstrate what they can do to take us out of the doldrums. But every now and then their decisions are sinking us further into the doldrums. So I bring the situation right home. And I won't take it to Russia. I won't take it to America. I say, what are we doing as a people to ensure that our lives improve? That we get the benefits of our democracy. That we don't stand in the sun to put people in leadership just because of their own personal aggrandizement. Thank you.
Thank you very kindly, Mr. Pratt, first place.
Well, you know, it has been very, very difficult to explain the current situation in Ukraine if Ukraine's president, Zelensky, was not a professional comedian. The fact of his being a professional comedian makes it very easy to explain what is happening in Ukraine now. Now, which kind of leader would assemble hundreds of thousands of bottles of beer, put petrol in them, and cover them with racks and give them to untrained civilians to go and fight off a Russian invasion? Which leader does that? And yet that is what Zelensky did. Zelensky actually said that his people could fight off the Russians with Molotov cocktails. So everywhere in Kiev, we had bottles of beer, empty bottles of beer, and we were packing it with petrol and racks. If this is not comedy, then what then is comedy? Very strange thinking. It doesn't end there. It doesn't end there at all. All the Russians wanted was an assurance that indeed Ukraine would not be used by NATO as a base for attacking them, and that Ukraine should not become a member of NATO and should not allow its territory to be used to attack the Russians. If that assurance was obtained by the Russians, there would be no war. Nothing would happen. My brother, you know what happened yesterday? After 21 days of war, after 21 days of bombardment, after nearly 3 million people displaced and so on, Zelensky now comes and says, we are not interested in joining NATO. We want to be neutral. I mean, what explains this if it's not comedy? I mean, if Zelensky was not a professional comedian, how can you explain this? He says, never, I won't agree, we will join NATO, we are a sovereign state. We are ready to face you. Come and kill our people if you want, we will resist. With bottles of petrol, we will resist the Russian army. I mean, incredible. So all these people who have died, all the things which have been destroyed, for what? Yesterday when I heard Zelensky, I couldn't believe it. And then, you know, my goodness, yesterday Zelensky was a pathetic figure. I said, no, we will not be neutral. As for being neutral, no, we will not be neutral because you are fighting us. But anyway, we would not join NATO and we have never joined NATO and so on. What is this double speak? What is this double speak? And people are dying. It's just incredible. You know, we all have to learn important lessons from what is happening in Ukraine. The United States of America and other NATO members were urging the Ukrainians to fight. We will bring you weapons. We will do this. We will do that. They were commending the bravery of the Ukrainian people. Then the Russian tanks started rolling in. 2 days after the Russian tanks started rolling in, what did the U.S. do? They called Zelensky and said, my friend, run away. They are coming. What can explain this beyond comedy? After all the noise they had made, they called Zelensky and said, my friend, run away. They are coming. And then Zelensky says, he's not running away. He said, you're a brave man. You're a very brave man. If you're not running away, you're a brave man. We will support you. And then the question was, what are you going to do to support Zelensky? One of the things that they announced was that all these Russian billionaires, they have beautiful, massive houses in Europe and so on. They have very expensive yachts and so on. Say, we will seize all that. How does that help Ukraine? How does that punish Russia? The millionaires, most of whom don't even stay in Russia. They have mansions in Paris, they have mansions in London and so on. You go and seize them and do what with those mansions? So you're going to seize the mansions of the oligarchs and seize their yacht, and that's a way of helping you. And Zelensky somehow believed that that will help him. In any case, if you are talking about oligarchs, Russian oligarchs, from what I'm learning, are only 15% of the oligarchs around the world. The majority of the oligarchs are in the United States of America. America has more billionaires. In fact, America has about 174 billionaires, those who fall into the category of oligarchs and so on. Russia has how many? Puny number, and so on. So, what is all this madness and stupidity? Unbelievable. Then they said, okay, we will do something else to support you. We are going to punish Russia. We are not going to make Russia, we are not going to allow Russia to be in a position to sell its oil and gas. And then very quickly they realized that most of Russian oil and gas were being sold to the NATO member countries. And that if the NATO member countries could not buy the oil and gas, their economies would collapse. And that the civil strife which would be promoted in the NATO countries would be so much. Then quickly the NATO countries met and said, no, we agree, we would take measures against the Russians and so on, but give us 27 months so that we can look for alternative sources of supply. Give us 27 months. Can you believe what is going to happen in the next 27 months? So as we speak now, Russia continues to sell gas and oil to even NATO member countries, as we speak now. The U.S. said, we are going to look for alternatives, you know. And one of the things that the U.S. did very quickly was to rush to Venezuela. Before this Ukrainian war, Venezuela was the home of the devil and so on. The government had Nicolas Maduro had to be uprooted. Now all of a sudden, the U.S. realized that after all, Nicolas Maduro was not the agent of the devil, and that they can do business with Nicolas Maduro. So they are rushing to go and do business with Nicolas Maduro. Well, I'm waiting to see what the Venezuelan authorities will do. But my goodness, if the Venezuelan authorities decide to do business with America against Russia, it will be a new development in history. Because without Russian support, they would have crushed the Venezuelan government a long time ago. And I think we are all waiting with bated breath. Then there were the African countries who jumped into the fray and started making all kinds of noises, condemning Russia and so on, supporting America, voting with the U.S. in the Security Council and so on. And you remember, we were here, and I was saying that these African leaders, what is wrong with them? What are they thinking about? Are they thinking about their interests? What do they think that they are promoting? Now you see what is happening. This is what they call the blowback effect of sanctions. And sometimes the blowback effects are more severe than the persons targeted with sanctions, the countries targeted with sanctions. The blowback effect. Look at Ghana. What has happened to us? And we are only suffering the blowback effect, too. Just the blowback effect, not the full impact yet. Of course, you do know that since Akufo-Addo's government came to power, petroleum prices had doubled before the Ukrainian war. So the Ukrainian war cannot explain what is happening in the petroleum sector. It cannot explain all of that. But we are going to become victims of the blowback effect. Yesterday I was listening to some officials of the UN and so on, and they are all crying. Because all these sanctions, what they are going to lead to is that there is going to be hunger in the world. As for the Russians, they will feed themselves all right. Look, the ruble will lose value and so on. But Russia is not a small country like Ghana. Russia is a big country. They will survive. But the hunger that is going to face the world, including people in the West, the poverty level, the way it is rising in the United Kingdom is unbelievable. I mean, who would have believed some time ago that people would be queuing for petrol in the United Kingdom on the streets of London? It has happened. It is happening now. The supply chain disruptions. Now you go to the supermarkets in the UK, you go to the supermarkets in European capitals and so on, they are empty because of supply chain disruptions. Agriculture throughout the world is going to suffer because Russia and Ukraine, in fact Russia more, produce about 40% of the fertilizer we require for agriculture in the world. You understand? If you take wheat exports, if you add Ukraine and Russia, the two countries account for more than 40% of the total supply of wheat in the world. So if we're thinking about all this, and then we ask ourselves, so what is the price to pay? We said, look, don't put weapons of mass destruction in Ukraine. Don't target Russia with your weapons. Let Ukraine, like Finland, become a neutral country. And there are many neutral countries in the world. It is not a crime to be neutral. Being neutral does not affect the expression of your sovereignty. The whole world would not be suffering these consequences. Finland is a neutral country. Finland has made it clear it will never join NATO. What was Kwame Nkrumah advocating when he led the formation of the non-aligned movement? Neutrality, positive neutrality. Kwame Nkrumah, Suharto, Fidel Castro, and so on. They advocated positive neutrality in international affairs. The same thing that Ukraine was required to declare in order to save the war. Ukraine said no. And you know, Zelensky, as for Zelensky, oh my goodness. They say he's a brave man. Maybe he is a very brave man. But you see, being brave without brains sometimes is a big problem. Zelensky actually went to the extent of saying that he wanted to station nuclear weapons in his country. How dare you? And if you want to station nuclear weapons in your country, you think that the Russians will sit down, fold their arms, allow you to station your nuclear weapons there so you can attack them in the future? Can't believe this. And mother, if you look at the geopolitics, Russia was afraid that the center of Moscow could be hit within 5 minutes if those weapons were ever stationed in Ukraine. Who would have accepted that? Now look at how the whole world is suffering. The whole world is suffering. You remember when this war started? I was here and I said, nobody profits from war. War is a very dangerous thing. In fact, it has more devastating impact on the working people, the working class, and so on. And therefore, we should avoid war by all means. Nobody will profit from a war. Yesterday, I listened to Joe Biden, and I laughed. I couldn't help myself laughing at a very serious situation. Joe Biden, who can hardly walk. You understand? They have to prop him up. He can hardly walk. He's sleeping half of the time, and so on. He is there showing bravado. We'll fight. You know, we'll help the Ukrainians to fight. Joe Biden helped who to fight. It's just a joke, you know. But this is an expensive joke. This is a huge joke, but it's the most expensive joke because the repercussions on us and the rest of the world are huge. One other thing which has come up as a result of this so-called war is just the deeply rooted racism in Ukraine. I mean, you can't believe it. I saw a documentary on what they called colored children. I'm embarrassed that in 2022, this can happen in any country. Africans who go there as students or businessmen and so on, when they go and cohabit with their ladies, and Ukrainians are very beautiful women and so on, and they have children, the women don't want to have anything to do with the children. Because it's like a taboo to give birth with an African and so on. So they dump them in orphanages. And if this is not racism, what else could be racism? I've seen videos of Africans escaping the war. They are told that, no, this bus is not for black people. This bus is for... What this war has exposed is deep-seated racism. And you see, if you think that the deep-seated racism is just on the streets and so on, you are wrong. Top officials in NATO countries and so on have said, how can this be happening in Europe? This thing, they're normally happening in Africa and other places. They have opened their mouth to say it. As for Africans, we can die. No problem. War. Europe is not befitting of war. It's Africa which is befitting of war. And so on. They open their mouth and they say it. Top level officials. And you are sitting in Ghana. You are sitting in Flagstaff House. You say, I support Ukraine. You support Ukraine for what? You support Ukraine for what? You don't know your history? You don't know your circumstances? You haven't heard about the blowback effect? You haven't heard Zelensky saying that national sovereignty is not the most important consideration and that they are going to be neutral? What is this? I wish that this war comes to a quick end. I wish that the Ukrainians and the Russians get back to the negotiation table again as quickly as possible. Yesterday they were all saying that they were making very good progress and that at the next level of talks they will be able to arrive at some understandings which will lead to ending the war. But the whole war was unnecessary, completely unnecessary, could have been avoided if some leaders had started thinking. 8 years ago, Russia started making its security concerns known to the whole world. So-called NATO leaders ignored it. In any case, why do you have NATO now? After the collapse of, after the dismantling of the Warsaw Pact, why do you have NATO? What communism is NATO fighting today? What communism is NATO fighting today? Unbelievable. But, hey, we are all in it.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Pratt. Let me remind you again that we are streaming live on Facebook, facebook.com/Pan-African Television. So you can leave your comment there. We will try and read as many as we can here. Well, we found a way of bringing Ghana and Africa into the conversation, but it's important that we deal with another very disturbing incident which occasioned, I think, 2 days or 3 days ago. The demolition of the Bulgarian embassy in Accra, which has sparked anger in Parliament. I listened to the deputy foreign affairs minister, who indicated to us that the Bulgarian on paper, the embassy on paper, is still, I think, still has about 10 years lease or so, and so they don't understand why this person moved it. But honourable, innocent of saying it with respect, let me come to you on this subject matter.
Well, the impunity in this country is increasing by the day. You remember about 4 years ago, there was a similar attempt to demolish the Nigerian embassy.
Absolutely, yes. Absolutely.
Now, people are just grabbing state lands. I said people, I've not mentioned anybody's name. Because somebody said some people were grabbing and they had to go to court. Grabbing state lands. With impunity. And when they do, and they give them the fiat, they go at 3 o'clock in the morning with the company of the police to eject the embassy officer. I don't know what they think about our international image and our reputation as a country. This lawlessness must stop. So many years ago, Professor Kumado wrote an article at the University of Ghana. It's just like robbing Peter to pay Paul. Okay, you said that you acquired the land from the local authorities, the Ghana chiefs, for the purposes of public development. And so you are going to build offices for public officials. And those offices were to be housed were to be used by these public officers to deliver public good. So you argued that the Ghana people should give you the land, so, because when you bring these public officials, they will implement policies that will inure to the general benefit and welfare of the people. And they gave you the land. You paid almost nothing for the land. So many years later, you have now, the land commission and some government officials have now constituted themselves into landowners. Landowners, so the fact that you have just been put in the office, you are now a landowner. And you are now presiding over the public lands and determining what happens to those public lands. You can't do that. As a minister for lands and natural resources, that was always my argument. I always argued. And you remember, when I got to the ministry, I put a ban on the sale of public lands. Because I understood my duty to be there to protect public lands. Because you see, government will need the lands. Akufo-Addo says he's building a cathedral. If we are allowed private people to convert all the lands where the cathedral is going to be built, would there have been land for a cathedral to be built? We had to demolish houses that had been renovated for the Supreme Court judges to be able to build the cathedral. Can you imagine that even if those houses were not there? And I can tell you as a matter of fact, that when I was there, applications were brought for the purposes of acquiring those lands. But they said, no, you can't do that. You can't do that. Kwabenye lands, you can't do that. I mean, government had a policy of acquiring these lands for public good, not acquiring the lands and in future selling it to themselves. And the Ula Wallace, after Kufo had taken part of the land for the purposes of developing the African village.
Yes, yes.
The other half, which had the poles.
Yeah.
I had incessant applications coming to me that those areas, they call it Lawales because, you know, that's the aircraft path. And so the poles communicate with the aircraft. But now, modern technology, they argued that you don't need those marks there to be able to communicate with the aircraft now. And so the land should be... I said, no. Let's leave it. When we leave the land there, in future, government might find a use for that land. Now it's gone. People think that those the decisions that we... That's why some years ago, Mr. Kosipra, I said it on a platform like this. When we lost power, actually many people thought that we were sitting in the office. Those of us who were in office knew nothing about governance. There was a general impression that Burma's ministers were just useless. We didn't know what we were doing. But I remember that before Nana Akandos won the elections, in the Basket case, you remember there was a lady involved, a Ghanaian lady. She sought me out as a lawyer and told me, these people, don't let them come to power. They're MPP, don't let them come to power. When MPP is in power, they are in power for business. They're in power for themselves. You think that the landing of the cocaine along the beach was done by reckless Venezuelans? They had collaborators. That's what the lady told me. It's come to pass. I mean, many people now know that there's a lot of grabbing, state land grabbing, and that people, the South African expression, state capture, that people have now captured aspects of the state and using it for their benefits. But it's a sad development. Everywhere that you go now, everywhere that you go now, you will see private development on public lands.
It's terrible.
It's terrible. The unacceptable and unfortunate development is that it even knows no bounds. They don't go to foreign lands. Even lands where embassies are occupying, they purchase them. And where you go, they say, oh, we have the right to sell the land. It's our state property, we have the right.
But what's Lands Commission's role in all of this?
But Lands Commission is the person selling the land. Land Commission is the person selling the land.
But then don't they know that
so,
the lease is not expired?
So
how would they?
So first of all, when I've even made the order, when I called the Lands Commission them to say, no, you can't sell public lands. And I'm putting, as a policy, I'm putting a ban on the sale of public lands.
You became an enemy.
Oh, they came in a delegation to my office. Unfortunately, they didn't know how to read the Constitution. I agree with them that, well, in terms of state lands, the Land Commission is vested with authority on behalf of the President to take care of public lands. I concede it. But the Constitution also says that in terms of policy on how to deal with state lands, the ministers are... and when I give directives, they have to comply. So I read that to them. So this is a policy. The policy is that we will not sell state lands. That's a policy. So go back and work with that policy. We will not sell state lands. Simple. And that's how we're able to bring some sanity into the state lands. Because people just go there. I mean, even officials come to you. First of all, if they want to get your support to dissipate state lands, they make offers to you. They bring surplus and tell you, oh, land is... they didn't put me in office to acquire land at cantonments. I was a minister of lands and natural resources. I don't have land in cantonments. I don't have land in East Lego, East what, airport. I don't have land. No. No. I said, no, this is not my responsibility. They didn't bring me to this office for me to acquire land for myself. For what? They brought me to protect the land. And the protection doesn't mean converting it to my own use. But I'm telling you, under this government, all the new up and coming persons have bought lands around all of them. They've bought lands like there's no tomorrow. But I say that it's possible to be a minister without acquiring land at those places, the prime areas. It's possible. Because why? Even it's immoral. It's immoral. As a lawyer, I couldn't buy land at East Legon. I made a minister, and the next day I have land at East Legon. Is it moral? Is it not it? Is it moral? The people were not even lawyers. They didn't even practice for one day when they entered politics. And they now have land at East Legon. They now have public lands all over the place. They have built marshes all over the place. This is why our politics is deteriorating. Because people are seeing it. But for people to go and acquire government lands on which embassies are situated, He said, no, no. 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 You can't do that. You can't do that because you will flout the Vienna Convention. Especially when there is evidence that there is, a running lease.
Yeah,
no, no, you can't do that. I mean, the lease confers some rights.
Absolutely.
On the occupier of the land.
I think even the new land act 1036 has even made some changes. It's automatically renewable.
But that's a distant.
Yeah.
But what I'm even saying is that it has not expired.
Absolutely.
If that expired and had not been renewed, then you could say that, oh, it has expired and not renewed.
Yeah. Mm.
But it has not expired. That's not expired.
In any event, if it has expired without renewal, is the
eviction and demolition the first step? It isn't.
Well, who is even evicting and demolition? It's like they've sold the land to a private person. That's the problem. That's the immorality I'm talking about. They sold the land. French embassy. When we were developing the Flagstaff House, we saw that their nearness to the Flagstaff House was such that it could compromise security. So we entered into discussions with them to move them away from that place. That property is still sitting in the name of what? The French embassy. Except that they're all using it for the purposes of an embassy because of the nearness to the Flagstaff House. But we had to. Even the old Nigerian embassy, we had to enter into agreement with them on land that was suitable to them, for them, for the use of embassy, before we could take the old Nigerian embassy. But who am I? Under this government, there appear to be no rules.
Well, thank you, Elvis. I think this is why you can only add a little.
Yes, I think that a lot of in-depth technical discussion has been made on this point. And for me, quite honestly, apart from seeing these headlines, I never knew that such a bizarre action had been taking place. Little did we know that even today it has happened. And so it reaffirms my consistent and persistent calls for the introduction of a high degree of nationalism in our body politics. Extreme partisanship would always breed situations of this nature for the capitalist benefit of doers of evil against the state. And unfortunately, K.O., the way you speak the truth, especially at a young age such as mine, you are disrespectful, you are arrogant, you are a liar, you are evil, you are a commotion causer, nobody should admit you into any place. These are the realities bedeviling the growth of the economy. These are the realities bedeviling the growth of Ghana. Look, we no longer subscribe to the universal principle of working for wealth. People just finished national service. National service. He has never established an Indomie selling center. He doesn't have a kiosk. He doesn't have a Lotto kiosk. He has no relation with business. You go to the Registrar General, he does not have any company to whom he is director. But because of the kind of political architecture we have, and because of the kind of capitalist, entrepreneurial, political activities we do, this is how riches is made. Me, any day, any time, I've always been proud that I have not, even as a member of a ruling party, I cannot be blamed for any of these, you know, kind of things happening. Look, embassies and diplomatic missions go beyond the scope of just intergovernmental relations. But it speaks volume of your reputation within the international domain and invites the rest of the international community to an understanding of the terms under which they must relate with you, they must relate with your businesses and your investors. So what you do to a country such as Bulgaria, You might probably think that Bulgaria is of no economic and social relevance to you. This is the kind of thinking I'm trying to read into the matter. As a student of international, I do my PhD in international affairs and diplomacy. And so you will understand that the temptation of thinking that there is irrelevance of certain countries relative to your social and economic direction, for which reason you must treat them with a pinch of salt, becomes high to people with this kind of political entrepreneurial capitalist orientation. But then the ignorance of it is that you are telling the rest of the international community, whom you need more, how they should treat you. Because look, the principle and doctrine of reciprocity can be by alliance. We have the shelter alliance strategies in the international security and foreign policy cooperation. So yes, what we have done to Bulgaria, Bulgarians can do so to us under the principle of reciprocity. If they elect not to do, another mighty country with interest in Bulgaria can hide within that alliance, take shelter in that doctrine, and then punish Ghana economically or otherwise. So it does not matter who is in government. What matters is, what are we doing within the international space? What has happened is unfortunate. It's a direct, shall I say, breach of the provisions of specific articles of the Vienna Conventions on Diplomatic Relations. The Vienna Conventions on Diplomatic Relations of 1961 is clear that diplomatic immunity for the purposes of coexistence within governments is key for the operationalization of the common good of humanity within the international space. So if this is what we do, we have undermined the provisions of that particular convention. And let's not forget, we're a vulnerable country ourselves, economically and in any other dimension. So we leave it that.
Well, you see, I can't believe that yourself. I mean, this doesn't happen in any civilized society. This can only happen in a banana republic. An embassy, a fully accredited diplomatic mission, embassy. And then people wake up with cudgels and so on, under the protection of the police, and demolish an embassy. What flagrant violation of the Geneva Convention. Unbelievable. And then I'm told that our Minister of Foreign Affairs says, oh, we're not involved. Not involved. The Ghana government is enjoined to provide protection to diplomatic missions. It's our duty to provide protection to a diplomatic mission to make sure that this doesn't happen. I am so embarrassed. I am so embarrassed, I don't know what to say. I mean, what is this? How can this happen? And the people went and demolished an embassy. In fact, this is an act of war. This is a declaration of war. To go and demolish an embassy is an act of war. It's a declaration of war. And we are sitting there, all we can say is that, oh, we didn't order it. When the police service is involved, how can government say that we didn't know, we didn't order it? Jesus Christ. This is what Ghana has come to. This is what Ghana has come to. Unbelievable. Yes, inflation is going up. Petroleum prices are shooting through the skies. The price of maize is quadrupled and so on. We know that. But this is another low. This level is another low. Very, very low level. Unbelievable. Every day we get embarrassed as Ghanaians. Every day there is some embarrassment. Now, it's so difficult for any Ghanaian to sit down and hold your head high up in the sky. Every day we have to bow down our heads in shame. Complete shame. Look at what we have done. And the explanation of the foreign ministry is that we didn't order it. And if this was the first time, maybe we could even excuse it. The Nigerian High Commission had the same experience. The Nigerian High Commission was raided. What is this level of lawlessness? Complete lawlessness. I don't know what to say.
Well, we are tongue-tied.
You remember we were at the brink of aggression with them?
Yeah.
They almost attacked Ghana. Now, if you look at Article 22 of the same convention on diplomatic, the Vienna Conventions on Diplomatic Relations, it tells you clearly that this is a declaration of war. When you touch even the premises, invasion of premises alone is enough declaration.
What surprises me is the bravado.
I think that the foreign ministry has said cannot be an acceptable excuse. The president, as a matter of fact, should summon the security couples, the minister for foreign affairs, the minister for the interior. There should be something done on this.
You see,
and
I agree with you. But the people don't fear the president.
He should make them fear him then.
They don't fear the president. That's why they are acting with impunity.
Because it cannot be an explanation.
Because apparently
the president should be shocked himself.
Last commission said they had indicated to them that they couldn't enter. But they flattered that. And
who gave them permission? Who gave them permission?
The question is who gave them permission?
That should be the whole point. You know,
it is why the president must summon the relevant ministers.
Somebody realized it will escalate, so let's just... Anyway, but if you have 84 unqualified cadets enter police college, perhaps this is there now. We may have. But thank you very kindly, Elvis, for your time. Unfortunately, we cannot deal with the other issues. I'm pained, but... Well, thank you, Honorable Minister.
But you see, when you have 84 unqualified,
then
you should be prepared to deal with the complicity of police in robbery activities.
Yes. Mr. Safra, thank you.
Sometimes the very qualified ones rather do it. Those who robbed were awarded best drilling cadets.
Even if you don't check their background.
Don't check their background.
Does anyone have background in this country? What are you talking?
Anyway, I'll see you guys when I see you. Have a nice day. God bless. Bye.
Good evening and welcome to Hot News. We are live on Pan-African Television. We are also live on Facebook at Pan-African Television as well as YouTube at Pan-African Television. We are also streaming on about 48 African countries. You can join in the conversation by sending in your views, comments and contributions on our WhatsApp to text line displayed on the screen. We'll make a time and read all those out for you. You can as well share the Facebook Live for other people to also watch tonight's edition of the program. Just subscribe to our page on Facebook, like our page, and of course you'll get our notifications and watch all our programs. Tonight on Hot News, we are looking at the decision arrived at by the Supreme Court on the voting rights of a deputy speaker. You know that the Supreme Court has ruled that it has not been provided for in the Constitution expressly that the deputy speaker or a deputy speaker who is a member of parliament cannot vote. A private legal practitioner sought to get interpretation for Article 102 and 104 of the 1992 Constitution. 102 talks about forming a quorum in parliament and 104 talks about voting on the floor of parliament. The Supreme Court says the decision by parliament to deny a deputy speaker who is also a member of parliament from voting would amount to disenfranchising the constituents of the said vote. Do you agree with that? However, this didn't go down well with the minority in parliament. They have described the judgment as a judicial support for the approval of the e-levy. They've also said that the judgment was a travesty of justice or a travesty of parliamentary justice. What does that mean? Well, we have Member of Parliament for Bulsa North constituency, Honorable James Agaga, with us in the studio. We'll delve deeper into the provisions in the constitution and then the outstanding orders as well to see whether the decision arrived at is the right decision or not. Honorable, good evening. Thank you so much for joining us on Hot News.
Thanks for having me.
My first question to you, why would you describe a decision by the Supreme Court, a very independent institution, as a travesty of parliamentary justice, a support for the approval of e-levy and a partisan decision? Those were the words used by the minority in Parliament.
Well, justice. First of all, we need to contextualize what the minority group or the minority in Parliament said in relation to the Supreme Court decision. Here is Parliament, one arm of government, and Parliament itself is a creature of the Constitution. For well over 30 years, starting from 92, when the current constitutional dispensation was adopted, Parliament has been regulated by its own standing orders.
Okay.
And it is the Constitution itself which allows Parliament to adapt for itself the standing orders to regulate its procedures. We've lived with this for so long a time. We never had challenges until quite recently when the Supreme Court made that incursion into the internal procedures and practices of Parliament. This is the Supreme Court. They have interpreted Article 102 and 104, and the controversy in Parliament clearly revolved around those two provisions of our Constitution. Now, our position has been very clear that the events leading to the first deputy speaker of Parliament, who counted himself as forming part of quorum for purposes of taking a decision and for purposes of being counted even under Article 102, was unconstitutional. But the interpretation of the court is that there are two thresholds. One, under what Article 102, which is the threshold for business before the House to commence. And that there is yet a second threshold provided for under Article 104, which is that half of the members of Parliament present and voting.
Right.
So they sought to draw the distinction.
Right.
And then came to the conclusion that whatever happened in Parliament, where the Deputy Speaker actually counted himself whilst in the chair, was proper and constitutional, and that our own standing order 109, which is
109.3.
Yes, because 102 deals with a different matter.
Right.
But the very specific order is 109.3, which is very clear that a deputy speaker or other member presiding shall not retain his original vote while presiding.
Justice, but the Supreme Court thinks that contravenes the
Constitution. I have read the judgment of the Supreme Court.
Right.
And when you go through the judgment, you can tell that the Supreme Court itself had a lot of difficulty, especially when it sought to state that, look, those making the case that the
where Parliament is master of its own rules and that the judiciary cannot make incursions into what is supposed to be theft that Parliament ought to control, advancing an argument which in their own estimation would amount to an introduction of the political question doctrine into our body politic. Then they go on emphatically to state that such a doctrine is alien to our own constitutional dispensational order, if you like. But the problems I have had with this reasoning is that if you just oppose that against decisions of the Supreme Court itself, previous decisions, such as to for an attorney general,
very well,
you are unable to come to terms with the incursions the Supreme Court has now made into what we thought was the domain of Parliament. Its ability to regulate without any hindrance its own internal procedures and to make determinations on matters that come before it. You know, and to for an attorney general was very clear that the courts themselves should not and ought not make those kinds of incursions.
Okay.
At the same time, the court did not make a conscious effort to distinguish, even though they cited to for an attorney general, but going through the judgment, they only cited to for an attorney general in laying out the principles of interpreting the Constitution. And to for an attorney general is about the locus classicus when it comes to position of the law on the interpretation of the Constitution. They cited that decision in respect of that particular matter. But in making a clear-cut distinction with respect to what is stated in there, right? And I tend to see some element of the so-called political question doctrine being espoused in that particular decision. And yet that effort was not made to distinguish the reasoning of Justice Suwa when he said that, the courts cannot inquire into the legality or illegality of what happens in Parliament. But what the Supreme Court did was to delve into matters that actually happened in Parliament when the first Deputy Speaker counted himself and actually...
But the Supreme Court is not, bound by it. It's decision. They can change.
Yes, that is true. That is true. That is true. It's not bound. It can make rich decisions.
Exactly.
That contradict its own previous decisions. And when that happens, of course, the latest decision would hold sway.
Right.
But the point I'm making is that in so doing, normally what they do is that they will try to distinguish.
Right.
And to explain why the previous decision should no longer have any efficacy. That, in my view, was not done in this particular judgment. And that is where I have a challenge. So when law students read to for an attorney general and read the decision that has now been handed down by the Supreme Court in relation to Articles 102 and 104, they are bound to suffer some confusion in their mind. Just as I have a problem comprehending how to for an attorney general was distinguished. I didn't see that in the judgment.
Right.
And so, whichever way you look at it, our position is that parliamentary democracy in our country has suffered a jolt. Because you have the situation whereby one arm of government, which is supposed to be co-equal, never mind that the power to interpret the Constitution is vested in the Supreme Court.
What about the power to interpret the Constitution?
It is vested in the Supreme Court. But you see, this is
a power that ought to be exercised very carefully, especially when it has to do with matters such as the standing orders of Parliament. Mm.
But they are saying that with the standing orders, I mean, the Constitution gave you that blessing, of course, to at Article 110, I think so, that Parliament would probably have a standing order which will regulate, you know, your activities and all. But that being said, the Constitution is your boss. So any order you make, if it contravenes the Constitution, that is void. True or false?
Well, that statement is true, but to what extent can you say that the standing order which has now been impugned,
the one struck out,
standing order 1093, sins against the Constitution? To what extent? When Article 102 is so clear and emphatic, because what 102 does is to exclude whoever is presiding, whether the person is a member, an ordinary member, or one of the deputy speakers,
right,
from being counted for purposes of quorum. Now there is a distinction which has now been made by the Supreme Court that there are two types of quorum.
Yeah.
The first is for purposes of the commencement of business, and the second is when a decision is about to be taken. I find it difficult to understand that distinction, because what do you think informed the decision of the framers of the Constitution to exclude the person presiding, whether he is a deputy speaker or an ordinary member, from being counted for purposes of quorum for commencement of business? Then you turn around and say, no, but for purposes of being counted for when a decision is about to be taken, that is the second quorum that they talk about, the one presiding, if he's an ordinary member or is one of the deputy speakers, that person can actually be counted and can
vote.
Why
do you also think that the framers of the Constitution have been very silent forming a quorum
to vote, but they
were very clear on forming a quorum to commence business?
Well, so that is why I thought that we should have the article, the construction of Article 104 should have been influenced heavily by the express words and the exemptions or the exclusion created in Article 102, but unfortunately that was not the
right
reasoning of the Supreme Court.
Okay.
But you see, Order 1093 sought to give clarity to the matter when it expressly excluded the deputy speakers from voting.
Right.
Okay. Now, that particular standing order should not even be considered in isolation. And what the court did was to consider that particular standing order 1093 in isolation. Why do I say so, Justice? If you look at Order 211 of the standing orders, Order 211 has this to say. Let me read this for purposes of clarity. The chairman, and here we're talking about committees.
Right.
And remember that the chairman of committees are also members of parliament.
Right.
They've been voted for. They also represent the constituencies, just as the second deputy speakers.
Right.
So the logic espoused by the Supreme Court should necessarily affect this standing order 211, because what that order says is that the chairman shall not have an original vote, but in the event of an equality of votes, he shall give a casting vote. So when the chairman is presiding
at
a committee's meeting, let's draw the line.
Right.
But he does not have an original vote.
Right. I agree.
He does not have an original vote. It means that when the committee commences business and a division is called, all right, for a matter to be determined by voting, he, the chairman, who is himself a member of parliament, does not vote from the onset.
Right.
That is why the wording is original voting.
Mm.
He does not have an original vote. The only time he can vote is when there is a tie. Then he comes in as some appellate authority to determine the matter because there is a tie. Now, here too, Justice, would you say that by taking away the original vote of a chairman of a committee, standing, this particular standing order is also unconstitutional? And so the point I'm making is that if the Supreme Court had taken pains to go through the standing orders in its entirety, they probably would have come to the realization that Standing Order 109, all right, sought to give some meaning and add some flesh, make it very easy to comprehend what was contemplated under Article 102 of the Constitution. But unfortunately, that was not the thinking of the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court said there was a second threshold for purposes of quorum, and then went on to strike down Standing Order 109. Now, how about Standing Order 211? As I have explained, because the chairman of a committee is also a member of parliament.
Maybe that wasn't in contention.
It wasn't in contention. But, well, I thought that we are dealing with constitutional interpretation here. And so once you interpret Article 102 and 104, and you come to the conclusion that the deputy speakers can actually be counted for purposes of quorum in the second instance under 104, and that they can even vote, and for which reason Standing Order 1093 would be in contravention of those articles of our Constitution, then necessarily they ought to have adverted their minds to what is also captured under Standing Order 211. But you see, I'm sure the Supreme Court had a challenge.
Right.
Because if they did that, right, the incursion we are talking about would have become so palpable for all to see. They would have, in a way, reviewed or revised the standing orders in a manner that some would say is far-reaching. And that is the problem they sought to avoid by limiting themselves to just one standing order. But if they had applied their own logic, the logic which informed their decision to strike down 109, then necessarily they ought to have impugned 10211 as well.
Let's get into the reasoning of the Supreme Court justices. According to them, before a deputy speaker of parliament was a member of parliament, meaning before whoever became a deputy speaker of parliament was a member of parliament, is a member of parliament, and a decision by denying the person a vote on the floor of parliament amounts to disenfranchising the constituents of that member of parliament.
Well, once again, Justice, that is the reasoning of the Supreme Court that we are bound to follow. But I have serious challenges with the reasoning contained therein, I mean in the decision, because look, if you say a deputy speaker by virtue of being elected and represents a constituency must at all times have the right to vote, you must also understand that the moment you accept to be nominated as one of the deputy speakers and you are elected in the process, that position comes with some privilege, some responsibilities. So in one breath, you cannot accept to enjoy the privileges that come with the position. For instance, you, when you are in the chair as a second deputy speaker, you exercise the rights of the speaker. You make rulings. You are accorded some courtesies by ordinary members. When you are speaking, an ordinary member who is on his feet must resume his seat. You even give rulings, and yet you are a member of parliament yourself. You may not be knowledgeable in, say, your understanding of the standing orders or even the constitution than other members. But the mere reason or fact that you find yourself in the speaker's chair instantly elevates you to an exalted position, and all others must respect that. So when you now occupy that position, one, you are expected to be neutral in allowing the debate to flow. You are expected to be unbiased. And so if you are in that position, and the logic is that, listen, because you are also a member of parliament, you can vote. But why is it that if you can vote, you cannot partake in the debate? So if we stretch the matter, I mean, in that manner, then somebody would say by parity of reason, you should be allowed to take part in the debate as well, because you are a member of parliament for a constituency. So when other members are debating and you are in the chair, you should equally be given the opportunity to be heard as to why a certain position should hold sway over some other position that may have been canvassed by MPs from the opposing side.
Right.
So you see, if you stretch this matter far, justice, one would say, okay, maybe the framers of the constitution made a mistake when they allowed deputy speakers to be elected from amongst members of parliament. But I don't think so. And that is why I thought that Article 102 should have had a lot of influence in our construction of Article 104. But unfortunately, that was not done. And that is why we think that the incursion by the Supreme Court into parliamentary practice and procedure has created a lot of problems for the legislature. And now, moving forward, we're going to have challenges. So some members are of the view that, well, if this is the logic reasoning of the Supreme Court, so should we continue to accord courtesies to a deputy speaker who finds himself in the chair because the speaker is unable to preside? Of course. You cannot assert all the rights that ordinary members would have ordinarily, right, when you become a deputy speaker. If you want to do so, then we would also take it that, listen, we have equal rights.
Right.
We have equal responsibilities. So if I rise, I'm on my feet, and you try to shut me up, I would simply just disregard you and treat you as if you are an ordinary colleague of mine. That is going to create problems for order in the chamber or in the House of Parliament. And that is why we thought that the Supreme Court's decision is a blow to parliamentary practice and procedure.
Now, let's look at the articles in contention, those that the private legal practitioner went to seek interpretations for. 102 says a quorum of parliament, apart from the person presiding, shall be one-third of all the members of parliament. Apart from the person presiding, it could be anybody, in the absence of even the two deputy speakers. I mean, a member of parliament could preside, true or false. So apart from anybody presiding, the quorum shall be one-third of all the members of parliament. But if you come to 104, it says, except as otherwise provided in this constitution, matters in parliament shall be determined by the votes of the majority of members present and voting. Majority of members present and voting with at least a half of all members of parliament. With at least a half of all members of parliament present. And then two says, the speaker shall have neither an original nor casting vote. Now, if you look at 1041, all members of parliament present and voting. The deputy speaker is a member of parliament present at the time of voting. One would have asked, I mean, a member of parliament who is not the speaker, because the 1042, you know, laid emphasis on the speaker. The speaker shall not have neither an original nor casting vote. If you look at the reasoning of the Supreme Court once again, they said it has not been expressly provided for in the Constitution that a deputy speaker cannot vote, especially when it comes to Article 104.
But that is where I thought that we should have done some distinction.
Mm.
Nobody is saying that when you become a deputy speaker, your right to vote is taken away all of a sudden.
Right.
You continue to reserve that right.
Mm.
But you see, we're saying that the only time you must not exercise that right is when you find yourself in the chair. Because when you find yourself in the chair, you are supposed to hold a certain balance. You are supposed to be neutral.
Mm.
You are not supposed to even partake in the debate. And yet one of the core functions of parliament is to deliberate on issues that come before it, issues
right.
that are of public importance. So if the position is that the moment you find yourself in that chair, you are precluded from debating, joining the debate, you must only sit back and regulate the conduct of members, give rulings where necessary. Why do you think that when you are in that chair, because it has not been expressly stated that you cannot vote because you are also a member of parliament, we must extend that right to you? And that is why I said that the reasoning of the Supreme Court now, if you stretch it, it would mean that second deputy speakers or ordinary members presiding can also assert a right to debate. And if they did that, I mean, how would you fault them in light of this recent ruling by the Supreme Court? And that is where I think that it's going to be challenging for Parliament moving into the future with this, I mean, decision of the Supreme Court. So nobody is saying that second deputy speaker cannot vote. We're saying that the only time you must not vote is when you are presiding. Or as Article 102 has stated, if you are in the chair, don't be counted for purposes of quorum. But where I have a difficulty is when Parliament commences business and a second deputy speaker in the chair has not been considered for purposes of quorum, you are not going to adjourn and come back. Sometimes you sit from the beginning, take decisions before you adjourn. So proceedings are held continuously. So at what point would you now draw the line that having not been counted for purposes of quorum, the one-third quorum that is envisaged under 102 of the Constitution, when it is about time for a decision to be taken, you would all of a sudden, having not been initially counted, would now be counted. You now be counted for the second quorum under 104 and then be allowed to vote whilst in the chair.
Is the quorum for...
Okay, so let me give you an example.
Mm.
When the voice vote is about to be taken, okay, members are the ones who would scream. All
right? Right.
In favor.
Mm.
Or if it's against, you scream nay.
Yeah.
Aye.
Mm.
But in the course of doing that, because the voice vote is one way of voting, the second deputy speaker or a member presiding would normally not take part in that. They are mute.
Mm.
And they must be attentive.
to be able to determine whether it's the eyes which is more tendrous or the nose.
Right.
Okay? Now, when the voice vote is taken and a member feels dissatisfied, then okay, the voice vote is inconclusive, it doesn't determine the outcome properly, and so you want a head count. At that point, we're saying that the speaker, having not taken part in the voice vote, should now step down and be counted. That is what the Supreme Court decision would now require us to do. But that is problematic, because the voice vote, when it's taken and there is controversy and a division is called, you're saying that let's count those who voted by voice. But remember that the speaker, the second deputy speaker, would have been sitting in the chair and not taking part in the voice vote. So what happens? So when you now count him, how do you reconcile that?
But the Supreme Court has distinguished a quorum formed under Article 102 from that of a quorum formed under Article 104. Why would they want to link a quorum formed under Article 102 to that of the one under Article 104?
Yeah, so that is why I have explained.
Mm.
I have explained to you that, and I've given you examples why the Supreme Court decision is going to result in practical absurdities. And one of the absurd situations I have just alluded to is the situation where the voice vote is taken. And at that point, the second deputy speaker, if he or she is the one in the chair, would not have taken part in the voice vote, because he or she would normally be attentive. You want to know which of the voice is it, the eyes or the nose, which is more tendrous, and you call for them. Having not taken part, if there is controversy and somebody calls for a division, then you are saying that the same person who did not take part in the voice voting should now stand up to be counted.
Why is it that your standing orders have provided for in it that a committee chair, when there's a tie, can vote to make a decision, but a deputy speaker who is a member of parliament, when there's a tie, cannot vote to make a decision?
So that is the problem. And so straight away you would see that the procedure at committee sittings is slightly different, slightly, only to the extent that the chairman of a committee is given only a casting vote. But you see, the problem is that the second deputy or the first deputy speaker may have the right to vote if he or she is not in the chair. But as for the chairman of a committee, at all times when he's present, he or she would chair the proceedings of the committee.
Right.
And the standing order says, look, for purposes of neutrality, you want to be a neutral umpire, you should be unbiased in regulating the procedure, the debate at the level of the committee. Originally, don't vote. But when there is a tie, because we don't want Parliament's work to grind to a halt, because if there is a tie and you are unable to resolve the tie, either for or against,
right,
you stultify the work of Parliament. So let's give the casting vote to the chairman. But so the fundamental question is it also unconstitutional to deny the chairman the right to have an original vote? Is it also unconstitutional? And that is why I'm saying that the Supreme Court, in shooting down what the 1093, did not advert its mind to 211. If they had done so, I'm sure they would have had a change of mind. Because what the Supreme Court itself did not want to do, and you will see, when you read the judgment, you will see that
they made it very clear that the only reason why they thought they had jurisdiction to deal with this matter of the first and second deputy speaker having the right to vote and be counted for purposes of quorum under 104 and the controversy surrounding 102 and its real meaning and effect is because the operationalization of standing order 109 seems to be in breach or was in breach of the constitutional provisions I have alluded to.
Right.
And they are, and that is why they assumed jurisdiction in the first place. So they were very clear that if the matter had revolved around only the standing orders and the customs of parliament, they wouldn't have gone in there. They would have respected the fact that parliament is master of its own rules.
What is the provision in order 1093?
The provision is very clear. It says a deputy speaker or any other member presiding shall not retain his original vote
while presiding.
It's as simple as that. Original vote.
No.
No mention is made of casting vote here.
Right.
So
in Parliament, when somebody calls for a division,
yes.
What do you do?
Of course, when somebody calls for a division, it means that after the voice vote, there's no certainty with regards to which side should be declared as having won.
So you can't.
Head count, yes. So head count.
That's voting.
That is voting. The voice voting is also permissible.
Right.
Yeah. But one would... The head count would put matters beyond doubt. If somebody gets up to call for a division, it means that, look, he's not very sure. He wants to be sure that what the speaker has, the speaker's verdict in terms of having called the vote for the ayes or the noes is indeed true or not. That's it.
Now, Supreme Court has ruled on the matter. You are not comfortable with the decision by the Supreme Court justice.
So you see,
what do you intend to
so
do?
You see, justice, so you see, this evening, what you and I have been doing is to critique the judgment of the Supreme Court.
Right.
And I want to make it very clear that the Supreme Court or the judicial arm of government is not immune from criticism. So let's make that point very clear. It's not immune from criticism. Right? It's short of insulting the justices, impugning ill motives. We are entitled, you and I, after the Supreme Court has handed down its decision, to critique it. And that is what you and I are doing now. Now, I'm saying this against the background, the backdrop of some people attempting to malign others, including President Mahama, for criticizing the verdict of the Supreme Court.
Right, even the deputy,
he
the
said well, he was not surprised about the outcome. And why not? Why not? So if he says he was not surprised, why should people take him to the cleaners? He's a citizen of this country. The Supreme Court is not above reproach.
In his caliber as a former president.
It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter.
A dent on the judiciary.
Why?
Isn't it?
Why? Is it a dent? He's simply saying that you have handed down a decision.
He was
which doesn't sit well with me.
Judiciary.
If anybody says President Mahama mistrusts the judiciary, it would be laughable because this is the man. When the Supreme Court ruled against him in the presidential election petition, he simply said, "I disagreed with your verdict," and then explain why he disagreed with the verdict of the Supreme Court, the failure of the court to hold Jean Mensah to account, etc. But nevertheless went on to say, I respect the verdict of the Supreme Court and call for calm amongst his followers. How can anybody turn around and say such a man, right, such a man does not respect the judiciary merely because he sounded critical of the judgment?
If somebody says I'm not surprised of anybody's
of course, because he was guided by previous decisions of the court, as in the presidential election petition case. So if the same court this time around has handled this matter in a manner that is not satisfactory to him, why can't he speak out in condemnation of the judgment of the court? You can't do so. It is within your rights to do so. So me, the attempt to create the impression that the judiciary is above reproach is reprehensible. That view can never stand the test of time. Nobody is above the law. Justice emanates from the people. So the judiciary exercises justice for and on behalf of the people. So if you exercise justice in a manner that doesn't sit well with some people, they are allowed to express their views.
Mm.
They are allowed to express their views. Remember here that nobody has insulted the judiciary. He just said, I'm not surprised. I disagree.
To say that...
Because you fail to hold A, B, C, D to account for her stewardship. These are statements that are permissible. Why do you think they are not statements that are permissible?
Parliament, the minority in Parliament, I recall vividly that he described the ruling as a travesty of parliamentary justice. The other time, Honorable Sohini was on this program, he described the ruling as a partisan ruling. In fact, the minority leader also described the ruling as a judicial support for the approval of the E-levy.
Justice, why would you say... when you say it's a judicial... you must put these statements in their proper context.
What
was the issue before the Supreme Court?
Hmm.
Some of the issues had to do with the passage or otherwise the passage of the budget. The budget policy statement.
Right.
And that policy statement clearly contained the proposals for the E-levy. Now, read the judgment of the Supreme Court. The controversy had to do with whether or not the first deputy speaker, in taking the decision to count himself for purposes of quorum, when they set aside the earlier decision of Parliament to reject the budget, he was working within the remit of the Constitution or not. So the Supreme Court said yes. They found that yes, what he did was proper. And if that was proper, it means that the passage of the policy statement had been endorsed. Was that not an endorsement of the policy statement, which had earlier been shut down?
An interpretation of the Supreme Court.
Of course,
that.
Yes. So if the minority says that what has happened is judicial endorsement of E-levy, what's wrong with that? If you put the statement in proper context,
support.
What's wrong with that?
Judicial support for the approval of E-levy.
What is wrong with that? Because that decision,
in effect, are you not
that decision
that?
Put matters beyond doubt.
In effect,
but for that
not?
Decision, listen. Mm. There were two competing decisions.
Mm.
What the minority side did after the majority had staged a walkout. Remember that the budget was clearly shut down.
Mm.
Subsequent to that, they came back and with the help of the first deputy speaker, because he counted himself, set aside the earlier decision taken by the same house. So there were two competing decisions here. Right?
Mm.
Now, the Supreme Court exercised its power of interpretation and came to the conclusion that the budget was duly passed.
Mm.
Was that not a judicial function? Interpretation, is it not the judicial function?
Right.
So if the minority leader says what happened was judicial endorsement of e-levy, because e-levy was one of the main reasons why we fought the budget so hard. If you don't put things in their proper context,
okay,
you can take things out of context and interpret them in a manner that would create problems for everybody.
What is your justification for a colleague of yours here on this platform describing the ruling as a partisan ruling?
Well, I haven't heard that. My colleague was here.
Yes.
And